I love days like these at the pool, but my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis can sometimes take me out of the moment. I'm ready to make a splash with clearer skin thanks to SKYRIZI, risankizumab riza. SKYRIZI is a prescription-only injection for adults who are candidates for systemic or phototherapy. At 4 months, most people saw 90% clearer skin when measured from head to toe, and many were even 100% plaque-free. People also saw significant improvement in psoriasis symptoms of pain, redness, itching, and burning.
Don't use if allergic to SKYRIZI. Serious allergic reactions, increased infections, or lower ability to fight them may occur. Before treatment, get checked for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor about any flu-like symptoms or vaccines.
Now there's nothing on my skin, thanks to SKYRIZI, and that means everything. Ask your doctor about SKYRIZI, the number one dermatologist-prescribed biologic in psoriasis. Visit SKYRIZI.com or call 1-866-SKYRIZI to learn more.
During Lowe's Pro Savings Days, save more on the brands you trust to deliver on the job. Right now, get a free DeWalt 20-volt max 8-amp-hour battery when you buy a DeWalt 10-inch 20-volt max dual bevel compound miter saw. Plus, get up to 35% off select major appliances. Save even more on what you need to keep the job moving. Our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Valid through 7/31 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Astonishing Legends Network.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts and listeners on the Astonishing Dead Letter Office are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Astonishing Legends Productions, the Astonishing Legends Network, or any affiliated entities or guests.
When something unexplainable happens to you, it can make you feel isolated or alone. But trust us, you're not. For over a decade, you've been sending your strange stories to Astonishing Legends. And now it's time for our fellow legenders to hear them too. Join us weekly in Blanket Fortiana as we dig through your intriguing messages to the Astonishing Dead Letter Office.
Tonight's episode, The Light Beneath the Boats.
Tonight's listener, Eric, is a more experienced observer than most folks, which makes what prompted him to send this story in all the more strange. He saw something very odd that may fall into one of my favorite categories these days. I've been talking about it for years on the show, and that's USOs, or Unidentified Submerged Objects. And on top of that, he saw this thing in the Pacific Northwest.
Yes, indeed. I know exactly where this is taking place here. The Pend'Oreille River, the far northeast corner of Washington State, and also into Idaho, it travels. But yeah, it's a big old lovely river, and there's a Lake Pend'Oreille, which is a very deep lake. Which I think that in Lake Coeur d'Alene they do submarine testing. It's so deep, so very deep water is always very mysterious to me. Like, what's lurking under the waves? Well,
I always heard you were from that general area, so I think it's interesting that Eric's story starts out there, although the bulk of it takes place somewhere else.
No, that's true. And another mysterious place, as we've learned over the years, Alaska. Lots of stuff on that. It has a scarier tone even with just their cryptids, their violent Bigfoots, and the large, black, ominous, dangerous, evil triangle pyramid thing that supposedly is in Alaska. But so it doesn't surprise me that this story comes from Juneau in that area there, because so many sightings and other weirdness happens there. But yes, back to your comment, I know exactly where Colville is and Deer Park and all that. So maybe I'll meet Eric one day. But yeah, it's a very lovely area. I don't get a vibe like I might in Alaska, but just because I grew up around there and you visited all the places and the river and the lake and all that. And they're all fond memories for me. So unless I was abducted at a young age, and these are all just screen memories. So, but that's another story.
Yeah, that's another story. Yeah. And also our friend Allison Jornland, who is co-owner of American Ghost Walks Company, her company that she owns with her brother, they just opened a tour in Ketchikan, which is 350 or 60 miles north of Juneau.
Oh,
I think she just came back from setting up the the tours there, which she sent me some pictures. It looks pretty cool.
I wish we could travel and visit them all the ghost walks.
I know. That would be a lot of fun. That would be a lot of fun, actually. Maybe we can someday. Anyway, the other thing that's really fascinating here about Eric's story is that this is taking place in broad daylight.
Yeah. At
11
yeah.
in the morning. The sun's straight overhead. So right away, we can set aside about half the usual suspects with lights under the water.
Yeah, just as he tried to set aside those mundane things himself. You know, he blinked, cleaned his sunglasses even, thought it was a bug, didn't know what it was. But it's a different thing than seeing the sun reflecting off the waves, which you've seen a million times, and
that's
we
right.
all have. And it's different. It doesn't move around like this thing did. And he looked off to the side to reset his eyes even. So he did everything he could just, you know, without any extra equipment, you could say. I would have loved it if he had some sighting tools like binoculars or something to get a closer look at it. But, you know, this thing stayed right where it was and it was doing its thing. It seemed to be under some kind of more intelligent control.
Yeah. And this is a careful guy on a clear morning. He's got some military experience, obviously. Something on or in the water that refuses to act like something you would see on or in the water. Forrest, I think it's your turn to read. So whenever you're ready, sir.
I hope this story finds both of you well and happy. I've been a longtime listener and love everything about your show. I'm active duty military and have plenty of time on my hands just sitting around on watch, and your show makes the hours go by very quickly, almost as if I fall into an enjoyable time slip event. For Forrest, my parents own a cabin deep in the woods that overlooks the Ponderay River, and we get all of our groceries from either Colville or Deer Park. If you know what I mean. This story takes place in Juneau, Alaska, around July of 2009. We pulled into Juneau for a port call for a few days. I, being an avid hiker, decided to check out the Mount Roberts Trail that promised wide panoramic views of the city. None of my shipmates were all that interested in hiking through the trees, so I was alone, though a few did know roughly where I was headed. After an hour or so of hiking, I stopped at a wide spot of the trail, and it did indeed offer a beautiful view of the harbor where the cruise ships moored. At the time, it was only one or two cruise ship docks. Now that whole part of the harbor seems to be dedicated to cruise ships, as I'm sure Scott will confirm on Google Maps. I sat down for a break and to take in the sights. That is when I saw what, at first, I took as a reflection or an odd shadow. It was a perfectly round spot of light, a little larger than a manhole cover. Light was the wrong word, and I lack a better descriptor, but it was a lighter shade than the surrounding water, and while it was daylight, there was nothing around that could have produced a light like this or such an odd reflection. It was about 11 a.m. in the morning, so the sun was high in the sky, but it was definitely not a reflection because of the way it moved. I watched it glide slowly from boat to boat in the harbor, maybe at about a human walking pace. It slid up to a moored fishing boat without touching it, then off to another, then around the cruise ship dock, slipping under it, finally coming to rest, circling a very small dock at about the middle of the harbor. It never lost its perfectly round shape, shifted its color or intensity, even when it went under something. It never touched anything but the water, and I'm convinced I was the only one who saw it, as boats drove right past it and the people on board did not seem to pay it any attention. It did rock with the wake of the boats, right in the tops of the small waves as they passed. All of this happened within the course of several minutes. Initially, I thought it was an eye floater, so I blinked and rubbed my eye to correct my vision. I then thought it may have been some kind of strange afterimage because I was looking at the water for too long, so I looked away to see if that would make it go away. I even cleaned my sunglasses, thinking it was a bug or odd piece of dust on the lens. But still, it persisted. This struck me as so odd, I turned around and headed back down the trail. After reaching the harbor, I made a beeline for the dock I had seen it circling. I did not see the light, and there did not appear to be anything particularly special with the dock. It was just a boat dock. I never felt odd, nervous, or afraid. It was just an interesting anomaly. I have no idea what it means, what it was, or why it was there. it will probably just go down as just another odd story in the ever-growing strangeness in our world. If nothing else, I hope you all and your listeners find it interesting. Thank you for everything you do, and I wish you all the best.
The paranormal surrounds us, and we'll dive back in shortly.
You know what's cool about this story starts, man? I think it's that Eric stops up on the top of the trail on that hike just to take in the harbor and really sort of absorb the moment, something that he can't explain. No, like, scrambling for answers or, you know, whatever, trying to take a million pictures. He's just watching that light drift from boat to boat and taking it in.
Yeah, I love stories like that where you go to do something, one thing, and then something else pretty remarkable happens. But it's a calm and measured approach because he's like, well, I wasn't expecting this. So he's analytical. And, you know, most of us wouldn't have been fumbling for a phone, I think, at that time.
Yeah.
But he just let that moment be what it is. I totally get that.
That's one of those things that I need to work on. Actually slowing down at the end of the day and simply enjoying something, mysterious or not, for what it is. When I do get it right for me, that's a good glass of wine, which I love. But I've never really known what to buy. Just grab something off the shelf and hope for the best. But then we found First Leaf. And folks, it just makes the whole thing easy.
Boy, it really does. Because you just answer a quick quiz about what you like. And First Leaf matches wines to your taste and sends them right to your door. Couldn't be easier. Every box comes with tasting notes and pairing suggestions tucked right in, right on the top. I love that. So you actually know what to pour, you know, for a Tuesday pasta, let's say, or a cheese board when company comes over.
Yeah, and the boxes have been great. My last one had a bottle of the 2023 Hawthorne Grove Limited Collection Chenin Blanc.
Nice.
It was absolutely amazing. My wife and I had it with a pretty simple cheese board, and it was the perfect thing to go with that. Super crisp and refreshing. A perfect wine for some pre-dinner apps. Now, First Leaf works directly with wineries, so you get award-winning bottles like that, which are the kind you can't always find locally. And on top of that, for well below retail.
Yeah, I just finished off a bottle of Gold Ghost. This shows you how much I know about wines. I usually go with the first one because I like the label. So,
yeah,
a Gold Ghost.
Both got a pretty picture.
Award-winning wine. All I know is that it paired perfectly with the barbecue shredded pork sandwich I had. So,
nice.
But the rest of it, look, you stay in control the whole way with First Leaf. Let's say you need a box by Friday. You move up the scheduling. Heading out of town, you skip a month. And if a bottle ever misses for you, you know, there's a 100% satisfaction guarantee. They will make it right.
Stop selling for wines that don't quite hit the mark. Head to tryfirstleaf.com/DLO to sign up, and you'll get 50% off your first box plus free shipping for an entire year.
That's tryfirstleaf.com/DLO. Tryfirstleaf.com/DLO.
Let's continue our investigation into tonight's dead letter.
This is pretty fascinating because when you look at this story, there's a lot going on here that there's features to it that defy a simple mundane explanation, not the least of which is where it passes under a pier or a dock.
Right.
That doesn't really explain what would be happening. And again, in the daylight, of course, at night, you could say, oh, well, a boat is shining a light on the water, trying to see fish or bring in a net or something like that. But this is also close to shore. And as Eric said, and since he basically taunted me to do it, I did look at this place on Google Maps and Google Earth, looked at Juneau, where this seems like this is. Because when you look on Google Maps, for example, that satellite image has three cruise ships lined up right in this one spot, and nested in between them is a very small pier relative to a cruise ship pier, not super small, but where smaller boats are called intermediate, I guess it's called the intermediate float or whatever that pier is, which I'm guessing that's about where this is, off of South Franklin Street in Juneau. And I appreciate that he described it. I love being able to look where something took place when we can without doxing people's homes or whatever, unless they specifically instruct us to, which has happened on the Dead Letter Office. But that's what's strange about this. That, like, the way that this thing is behaving and how it's defying a simple explanation, it goes beyond, and I think you said this in the cold open, it goes beyond just like sun glinting off the water or a sun dog. There's something different happening here. And I don't know if there's a simple, mundane explanation for it, other than sentient plasmoids.
It could be an underwater version. I mean, you had said this in the introduction. And again, I think it points to how we think about this type of phenomenon and these types of anomalies in that we're humans. So it's like we followed a very linear and logical progression of technology in that, we start off in the Stone Age and you make tools, and then fast forward a few thousand years and you have the Industrial Age and machines and things that emit light that aren't powered by fire, just that aren't candle flame, which is a huge leap. And that's the progression that we can understand. And before, it was like, okay, so then you have things that fly through the air, but then you have other things that fly or sail or glide under the water, under the waves. And that speaks to the two different types of terms, unidentified flying object or unidentified aerial or anomalous phenomenon, UAP. And then you have USO, unidentified submerged object. And now we've come to believe, or I have, that those might all just be the same thing, is that whatever their technology is that there's no difference to them. I mean, minorly. Slightly.
Transmedium.
Yeah, they're transmedium craft. Yeah. And, who knows? They're not all like that. They're of different, just a multitude of different types of craft and shapes. And now that craft might even be sentient itself or biological itself, but it's still a craft of sorts. But it has its own intelligent control. A lot of fascinating concepts about all this. And when you talk about something like this, I love the description in the story that light was the wrong word. It was just a different or lighter shade of a circular patch than the water around it. That maybe it was emitting some kind of light, but not in the same way that something, like a traditional underwater light would, or somebody even with like a, one of those underwater scooters and a spotlight would be doing. Yeah. It wasn't like that. It just was a shape that was a different color than the surface water or the water around it. And it moved much quicker, it would seem, than like a diver would. Somebody just kind of floating around. There's no bubbles either. It's just effortless. It glides. It has shape. And it seemed to be checking things out. It's not a manta ray or any kind of animal, it seems like, because they don't move like that. And they're pretty invisible from the surface, especially at that distance. I doubt you could see that without, some magnification instrument.
The water here, too, is not super deep, by the way. It's the Gastineau Channel is where this is. It's 90 to 120 feet.
Right.
And in some places, as shallow as 45 feet. It was glacially created.
Yeah.
It's fine for cruise ships or whatever.
Sure.
But in terms of of course, who knows? I don't know what the specs are. If you're a USO, it's like, oh, we're not putting a base there unless it's at least 300 feet deep.
Right.
I don't know. But you do wonder if these things are doing this, where are they coming from and where are they going to?
Yeah.
Like Cotton Eye Joe.
That's right. It's in an alternate universe type of way. But this is interesting in that just the way it moved. But like you said, things are crafted for human purposes. And it's like if the channel or the port is not deep enough, they can, they can gouge that out and manufacture it. But something is checking out the ships, it seems. It was interested in the craft of another kind. Well, that makes sense if it's another type of intelligence. They want to see what we got. And it seems to be moving around purposefully rather than zigzagging around. If it did really quickly, that's another question. But this thing seemed to be kind of gliding around and checking things out. And again, I don't think it's some kind of animal, because think about it. What nature does, especially with sea creatures, from the top looking down, is they camouflage them. Manta rays, they're dark on the top and light on the bottom. So you're looking up and they're harder to distinguish. Everything under the sea, most of it, it seems like, is wanting to be camouflaged and not give away its position like this thing did, even unintentionally. But if you've ever been snorkeling, I remember one time being in Hawaii and the first time I ever went snorkeling, and I saw, oh, cool, there's like a small octopus there, kind of gliding around the rocks with a bunch of sand. And it wasn't that rocky, but, there'd be an occasional rock there. Now, this is what I found fascinating and how well nature works, is that I've got snorkel on with a mask. I purchased an underwater disposable camera. And I wanted to take a picture of this thing. And so I'm watching this thing kind of crawl around on the bottom, trying not to disturb it. And by the time I got the camera up, it curled up into a ball and I couldn't tell it from the other rocks. For me, it essentially just disappeared. And oh, it's like, whoa, it was just here. I know it's one of these things here, but I can't tell the difference between it and a rock nearby with a background of sand.
Right.
And so, again, this didn't seem like an animal type movement or even appearance from that location. And so what was it? Well, we've also seen, I think, evidence of things moving around underwater where they are self-illuminating and quite brightly. And I've mentioned this before. If you watch the George Knapp series, Investigation Alien,
yes,
which is still on Netflix, if you want to check it out, really good series.
Yes.
But I think it's in episode 4 or maybe towards the end. I think it was one of the last ones because it was kind of a bombshell where they have boats out at night near, I think, Catalina and some of the islands out there off the coast of California. And
yeah, they were close to Catalina.
Yeah,
that's right.
And so yeah, they're seeing lights, very bright lights, orbs of light under the water moving around, and they get it on film or they get it on camera. And, you know, there's no divers there. There's no other craft. It wasn't like a light on some other submerged craft. It was just the light themselves moving around, and you can see them. So
right,
if you're curious, take a look at that episode. I urge you to watch them all, but that's a different kind of thing where that thing's brightly illuminated. It goes under the water. They also have footage of something that was in the air and then submerges itself. It goes underwater, under the waves, and that's a different look. This is something entirely different, I think, or you know, maybe related, but obviously you're looking at it in the daylight. It's pretty curious to me. I would have loved to have seen that.
Here's an observation I want to make that I did not pre-plan. I didn't think about this when we had our notes for what to talk about here. But in looking at this on Google Earth, I decided that I wanted to see where this trail was and how close he was to the bay, right? And so the trailhead is down in Juneau, like a good little ways away. And then it goes up on the top of this ridge up here that you guys can see if you look. There's actually a place called the Trail House, like T-R-A-L-A-L-E house, up on this trail that you could hike up to, I guess, and probably have drinks. Now, the altitude between the trail, like where it's on the crest of this ridge overlooking the bay where the cruise ships are, that's 1,400 feet from what I can tell on Google Earth, you know, and obviously down to sea level, zero. So he's basically up on top of a 14-story building looking down at these docks. And so what that makes me wonder, Forrest, is how big was this thing?
Oh,
because, I mean, obviously he could compare it to the cruise ships.
Right.
You can see them. Although the scale of them is going to look kind of weird too, being that far above them. So my question is, was this thing just a lot larger than he thought it was?
Yeah.
And the other thing I was going to say was he talks about it undulating with the waves. It's like, I don't know how you could really tell from up there, but maybe you could. Was it necessarily reacting to what was happening on the surface,
right,
or was that light refraction and it was underneath, you know?
That's a great point because we have limited information about this incident and interaction of sorts, or just observation, I guess. And the thing I wonder about it is like, okay, I'm ruling out reflections from anything or something mundane under the water, like a diver or a submersible kind of vehicle that's man-made, because again, that would be a different perception, right? They're not just kind of round.
Right.
I want to know, what is the shape of this thing? Is it like flatland, where it's like a 2D form that is just kind of riding the motion of the water, but it's really only 2D in a weird sense, if that makes, there's no thickness. It's like a flat piece of floating plastic. But of course, that's not a good explanation. That wouldn't be moving around that quickly like that. Like, what is the shape? Is it a cylinder where you're only seeing the top part of it? Or is it a ball where if you look at a ball and don't see any shading around it, it just looks round? Like, what is this thing?
Yeah.
I want to know.
Do they blow up in funny shapes at all? Not unless you think round is funny.
Oh, that's my favorite line.
No one's going to know what that's from. It's been gone. That movie is so old now.
People I know, but it's my favorite. It's such Coen Brothers humor.
Raising Arizona.
Yes.
Perfect.
If
you haven't seen it, see it.
It's such a great example of Coen Brothers type humor. Just in a in a weird tense situation. But the old timer. The premise is that the two robbers or the kidnappers go into a convenience store run by an old timer, and they want to entertain the kid. They're actually good guys. So it's John Goodman, and I forget the other actor's name, but he's terrific. And they want balloon animals. They want to twist up balloon animals. So the other guy asks him, like, do you have any balloons that blow up in funny shapes? And the old guy goes, not unless you think round is funny. And yeah, such humor. Anyway, that's but great.
William Forsythe.
Oh, yes. How could I forget?
Yes. I had to look it up. I couldn't remember
his name. Yeah, I know. He's he is amazing. Terrific, good character actor. But the point is, and this is another thing that ties in with what we're learning now about these craft, is that some can change shape. And then also it's the purpose. I mean, the whole world of thinking about these kinds of, I guess you could say, secret machines is that they have different purposes. They're different forms. They're made of different things. And what they might be is not what we can perceive. Meaning right. You may not understand really what they are or how they work, certainly, or you know what they're made of, or the shape, or this freaks me out the most, the reason or the purpose for them.
Well, you said something to me the other day, and the idea about the what are they calling them? The plasmoids? There's another
one. Yeah, there's a sentient plasmoid.
It's not
orbs.
Sentient. I think I made that up.
No, no, it's
was that part? It's sentient plasmoids.
Yeah,
well,
because the idea is that we did actually just talk about this, I think, in a dead letter previously.
Because one of the things you said was like the intelligence level. That's why I was like, wait, yeah, you're that's telling me, and we do want to cover these on the main show, by the way, if we can find enough information, but that it might be as smart as a dog or as unintelligent as an insect.
Well, okay, listen.
And I was like, oh, this is a newsflash to me. I just assume these things are flying, these orbs that are flying around are, if you believe in orbs,
if you believe any of this at all. That water at all.
That they're highly intelligent because obviously they're flying around. They're balls of light. They can go do whatever they want. But it's like, no, what if this just evolved as some side effect of like interdimensional overlap? This is just some kind of creature that evolved. And in terms of being transmedium, I mean, does it even know it's underwater? Does it know where it is? It's like when you look at these things flying around at Skinwalker Ranch on that show, or you read about stuff, things are passing through solid rock into mountains, out of mountains, up above. They're visible. They're invisible. Now they're going through water. Mm-hmm. They're going, you know, that's the definition of transmedium. But what's really funny to me is the idea that it's just like a fly buzzing around your food at a table at an outdoor cafe.
Well, possibly. Here's the overall idea is that there could be a range of obviously types of orbs. Like that's a class or classification of things we see in the skies that are anomalous and now most likely underwater as well. But this is what I was talking about at the beginning of our episode here, is that we have to expand and change and accept and adapt the way we think about these things. Because what you just said is what we all logically think is that, oh, if these things are flying around, they might be a machine and they're emitting light, but something is controlling them either remotely or they're inside these things. Like it's a craft. Like we could think like they're in a bubble flying around, having a lot of fun, buzzing our World War II pilots, you know, and that's where the term Foo Fighters comes from because they were getting buzzed by these large orange orbs that they could not outrun. That interacted with them didn't really cause any harm, but just a lot of consternation and worry as you're on a dangerous, deadly mission over the skies of Europe and these things are buzzing you. These bogies are of unknown origin. You want to know, are they German or should we be worried? Do we have them? Are they ours? All these same questions we're thinking about now. But then that's all I knew. But so we think about them again, the logical path is that, oh, something intelligent must be really controlling these things. Yes, what we're talking about is that paper, and it's finally time that we took a pause here. We looked it up and researched it because I think it's going to be a very interesting and important paper that I first saw from an Instagram reel or clip that talks about research into what's called sentient plasmoid life, which if you keep tabs on all this kind of stuff, was also mentioned by David Grush in that last big press conference in Washington. Talking about this type of life form. And I'll just set it up here. But what the paper and the clip described was research by some scientists who just kind of gathered all the information we have on this that I guess it was available to them and started to deduce the patterns and classifications of these types of entities in all various manner of anomalies. And what they mentioned that caught my attention was that these plasmoid life things, entities, I guess you could say, are maybe not all what we think of as UFO craft. And that's what I was just talking about, that they may not be a type of nuts and bolts type of craft giving off plasma light energy or even remotely controlled. They might be individual yet connected in a hive mind type of way, sentient beings, but not sentient in the way that we think, that there's different levels. And yes, I remember now, I had briefly mentioned this in a past Dead Letter Office episode we had just did. My thinking on that was that it sounded to me like what was described to us by a psychic medium about the nature of a sludge type entity, which we, of course, covered in our two-part series, The Sludge Entity. And the, what was interesting is that, and again, this, you have to expand your thinking on this, in that we think that you're a demon, you're a ghost of some departed relative, you're this or that, but it's more things that we can wrap our heads around. And what was described to us by the medium in the case of my friend John and his family is that this type of sludge entity is not intelligent on the level of even a deceased person or a more powerful, capable being, as even Buddhist philosophy on spirit life might tell you as well, that there are different levels. Like there's some ghosts that are, they said, just incapable. They're hungry. They're hungry ghosts. And they're the most destitute type of spirit being, just and not as powerful as us, not as directed. They're just kind of in limbo, constantly wandering around and trying to feed off energy, which sounded to me like a sludge entity. And that was it described that it's a lower level of intelligence, still intelligent in a way, but not highly intelligent, not prescient, can't read your thoughts really, not giving you answers to hard calculus questions, things like that. But it has some intelligence. And so this paper describes some plasmoid orbs as having the intelligence level of perhaps like insects, the way that insects buzz around, but they have innate instincts in that they just do what they do. I mean, how does the jewel wasp, how does that commandeer a cockroach and use ride it around holding the antennas like a zombie piece of cattle, you know, bug cattle here with a cockroach? All these amazing things that insects can do, but they don't really think about it. It's just part of their nature and instinct. And what they perceive is much different than we do. I always talk about this, like a bug flying straight at your face doesn't know that you're a giant beast with a fly swatter that's about to kill it. It's just like, I don't know what that is, but it's giving off some pheromones that I like, so I'm going to head straight towards it and meet my end.
Yeah.
It doesn't think that. Yeah. It's just doing what it does. And then there's a level of plasmoid life that might be as intelligent as smart cats and dogs, where it's not right to our level, but they are pretty smart. They can kind of communicate. They have goals and desires, and they just do what they do, like a wild animal being curious about you, following you around. And so maybe that's what some of these plasmoids are, is that a type of intelligent life, but at a different level, either more advanced than us or less. Now, here's the thing about that paper, that like everything that I take, and this is my view and approach to everything I hear that's that way out, or even things that seem very common and should be common sense these days, is that I like the concepts and I can take those singularly and individually from various sources, let's say, and approach it as an interesting intellectual thought exercise, or what they do in science. Right. Let's take this premise and run with it to see.
Or thought experiment.
Thought experiment. Maybe. There you go. Yeah, that's the word. And
yeah,
so
yeah.
The nature of this paper, however, should be taken with a grain of salt. Scott will explain here about what's behind this.
I'll tell you this. So this particular paper, it was published in 2024 in the Journal of Modern Physics, I guess, as part of scientific research publishing. The paper is titled Unidentified Anomalous Phenomena, Extraterrestrial Life, Plasmoids, Shapeshifters, Replicons, Thunderstorms, Lightning, Hallucinations, Aircraft Disasters, Ocean Sightings.
And just the length of title you love. It goes on for a paragraph.
Everything by Ron Gabriel Joseph, Oliver Planchon, or Planchon, and depending on how he says it, Christopher Impey, Richard Armstrong, Carl Gibson, and Rudolf Scheild. The abstract for this is, as documented by NASA Space Shuttle Films and detailed in this report, self-illuminating, pulsating, plasma-like UAP UFO plasmoids, in quotes, have multiple shapes and sizes, are attracted to electromagnetic activity, and travel at different velocities from different directions, making 90 to 180 degree turns, as well as colliding, intersecting, and piercing other plasma, and have been filmed by U.S. Navy personnel et cetera, et cetera. The abstract goes on. We'll provide a link to the paper. So this was published in October of 2024, and it's been getting a lot of attention lately. But by the same token, in doing some research on this, scientific research publishing is not described as exactly the most reliable source for these kinds of papers, and that there are issues with some of the authors of this paper as publishing particularly fringy, unresearched or things that aren't really backed up, and also being very litigious mm-hmm. with government organizations like NASA. But some of the things that it says about this particular paper is that it relies on a lot of methodology that's questionable. The evidence in it is freeze frames pulled from heavily compressed nighttime NASA video, put through photo editing software, sometimes magnified over 1,600 times. And so there's a lot of leaps made in the presentation of this. But what I will say, and I by the way, I'm not coming around to say, oh, that's poppycock. Everyone needs to open their minds and et cetera, and you know, embrace these fringe ideas. But what I am saying is that what we've seen, you and I, through the history of our show, is some very bizarre behavior from these orbs that might fall into the category of what Eric saw under the water. And whatever the case about the pipeline that's bringing this paper to us and putting it forward, and then we have folks on Instagram, depending on your algorithm, telling you, oh, look at this paper. Mm-hmm. You got to take the paper with many, many, many grains of salt. Conversely, though, we have seen some weird stuff. I mean, even in footage that people shot at the Sally House, we've seen stuff going on. Take a drink. And that's on our YouTube channel, loaned to us by Professor Sean Daly. You can still go these orbs floating around in the nursery there.
You take everything with a grain of salt. Everything is entertaining to me. Interesting here and there. And I can cherry pick concepts. It's like, again, I don't know. Don't ask me what's really going on. But I like...
Is there air out there?
Yeah.
You don't know.
From Galaxy Quest. Love it. But the point is that any paper, and you know this, any topic outside of the very mainstream, what we know, let's say the Mick West approach or Michael Shermer, is that there is nothing, until you show it to me in a jar, there is nothing that can't be explained or that's anomalous, really. It might be really weird and a one-off, but it falls within the main, guardrails of the world of scientific inquiry that we know of. And so, okay, that's a good starting point, I think. But anything, I guess if you're asking AI, whoever, which is all also based on very mainstream guidelines, is that any talk of any of this is wacky and woo-woo and the people are suspects and... they've had some problems with this or that organization, or they were fired from NASA, so they got a real beef with them. So take that, and you should consider that a little bit. But like I said, I'm more interested in the concepts rather than the ad hominems or whatever from these people that are presenting it or the paper. It's like, just give me the ideas. I'll decide what I think is like too out there, or whatever. I like that. Yeah. And so, but my point is that any discussion, what of your top tier journalistic reviews and peer-reviewed paper mills, that look at this kind of stuff is going to take any of this seriously anyway. Who's going to fund this? Nobody, it's not going to come from, well, here's the thing. There might now be two sides to this, a shadow side, which is, the top minds in the world have studied this. It's just all secret. You're never going to know about it. They can help it. The other side is that, all the public-facing stuff, the universities, the research think tanks and groups, they're not going to touch this stuff because what's the point? There's still a stigma.
It's such a strange lane to me as somebody who is routinely publishing these fringy ideas in these sort of questionable peer review journals that are also apparently just another predatory capitalist business model, designed to create something viral that looks academic, that then gets sucked into the conversation. What a strange lane to find yourself in as, in theory, an educated person, scientist who's putting this stuff. What makes you go, instead of focusing on extrapolating Einstein's theory of relativity, I'm going to focus on publishing papers about plasmoids and try to get them to go viral right. or get involved in some way. And that's how I'm going to make my living. It's such a strange thing. But the other thing, the other flag it raises for me is it does make me wonder about disinformation and misinformation sure. and the pipeline of all of that. And why is this happening? And yeah. are these people getting help from the alphabet agencies to control the public perception yeah. of something?
One way or the other.
Conversely, yeah. but here's my other thing. Conversely, Eric saw this thing yeah. going under the water, seemingly sentient underneath docks. And he's 1,400 feet above the bay looking down on this right. thing and very clearly seeing it. And this is a seemingly sober individual, yeah. active duty. He's not just some, you know, hippie up on the Appalachian Trail. All due respect to them. Many sure. of them are my friends. But my point is, in this category, so there's like this weird juxtaposition, or I guess this concurrent existence of people having these real world experiences that these fringe papers describe possibly pretty well. But then the fringe papers are decidedly fringy
exactly.
and not really peer-reviewed and are profit-motivated yeah. and just another case of like widespread viral clickbaity yeah. misinformation. However, you and I are seeing our people are sending us stories yeah. about this stuff that aligns with that weird crap. So like, what is happening? What's happening? I'm
what
frustrated.
What is happening? Exactly. But getting back to what you're talking about, I think this is the whole crux of the Eric story here is that, again, you start off with something you assume or accept that Eric saw what he saw and he's describing it very accurately. And again, a trained observer because he's a seaman. He's looked out on the water quite a bit, I imagine, during his service
yeah.
with the Navy. That's what they do.
Yeah,
they look for yeah. Things like this and are trained to look at it on the medium of water. We start with that, is that he saw something, he recognized it as anomalous. I'm going to accept that it was and that he's telling the truth. And he also has, because he's a longtime listener, a knowledge of all the strange things that are in the genre. So we start from there. Now, how do you react to that? Well, you talk about like these respected, quote unquote, journals. And now, of course, we're getting so much more inside news about journal mills. And, you know, any academic that I know of, I've met and you can read about or talk to will say, what does the university tell you? Publish or die. Publish, publish, publish. We need papers from you. Well, what does that gain other than in the end, it means money. So you could say like, well, they're just a capitalist venture. Like it's like Fate Magazine. Well, I'm glad Fate Magazine was around because no one else is going to touch this stuff. And when they do, it's like Time Magazine runs a piece and it's child level. It's child, especially if you know anything right. about it, it's like, right. oh, you know, and then they used to do this. I'm glad they're stopping, but like it's covered by broadcast news and they play the X-Files theme because that's their approach. Like, woo-woo, it's kind of wacky. You're kind of weird, aren't you? And it's like, it's woo-woo stuff, but we'll report it, but we're not going to take it seriously. That's starting to change, but it's not there yet. Yeah, even if you, why does the broadcast news decide to report something like this? They don't have to, and a lot of them don't because there's no, other than it's to peak public interest, but you know, you could say they don't really believe it. And maybe they're starting to now because there's the tide is turning, but we're still not there yet, or even a good portion of the way. But the academic world is that they're still solidly cemented in, you know, this is fringe and we're not going to cover it. And if you talk about this, your career is over. And that's the gatekeeping that's always happened and will continue. And my question is, if the government finally came out and said, okay, here we go. It's disclosure day. These things are real. We're not going to show you an alien yet. Here's the baby steps is that we're just telling you that this phenomenon is real. It's so limitlessly varied and it's going to freak you out, but some things about it are pretty wonderful. And yes, we've been sitting on technology that could have cured cancer 70 years ago. But aside from that, it's real. Then you have this official worldwide announcement. Then what are the people who make it a living to deny all this stuff or the mainstream academic institutions, your research facilities, even people who are professional skeptics? What are they going to do with that? My speculation is that they will proceed with what they've been doing. And that, okay, yeah, they just announce it, but there's some other ulterior motive. And there might be, especially in the crafting of the narrative,
we don't know.
What would happen if Tesla came along today and it's like, I've figured out a way to transmit electricity to everyone wirelessly?
Yeah.
Everybody would be just like, get this guy out of here. And it's like, if there was ever a dude that was seriously figuring that out, it was Nikola Tesla.
Well, Tesla did that actually, or he was working on it. If you've ever heard of or studied the Wardenclyffe Tower, it was an experimental wireless transmission station that was designed and built by Tesla, I think Long Island, I think 1901, 1902. Yeah. And so you could do everything with it. You'd transmit messages, you could have telephony, facsimile images across the Atlantic Ocean, all these things. The problem that he even had cars, if you remember, Scott, he outfitted like a Model A's or whatever with a giant antenna. And you can transmit wirelessly through the air enough energy to power the car. Problem is, if you do that, now you get no radio, nothing, because it's putting out so much electromagnetic energy and static in the air that nothing else works. Like, you're not going to get TV reception, radio reception, any kind of wireless communication. So there are some
kinks.
But
you feel like they might have sorted that out if they kept working.
I think somebody
it.
Did. You would have to direct it, beam it. And actually, what's interesting to me is that that was one of the concepts that was brought up by Edgar Cayce in one of his readings about Atlantis.
We have a series on him, folks, by the way, if you want to know more about him.
The idea is that what he came up with in his reading is that the Atlanteans found a way to have transmedium travel with craft and a form of global television and a form of these other communications and wonders in their own way. And the way they did is that they had centralized or multiple centralized power stations that would open up and turn on, and it powered everything in their world. And it all ran off a wireless beamed form of energy rather than the craft itself. That's a pretty cool idea. But that was, you know, if you're talking about Edgar Cayce coming up with sci-fi stuff, well, that would be the 1930s before a lot of this stuff was made public knowledge here. So if you're talking about these ideas, though, and kind of like what Eric saw, like, okay, I start off with the idea is that let's take that he did see something real. What's the reaction to it? Well, the mainstream reaction is that it's got to be ball lightning. It's got to be a form of something like that. It's a natural thing. Although it doesn't fit all the parameters, you know, this is what I love about that kind of point of view is that, well, it doesn't really fit any of these other parameters, but that's what we got. So we're going with it. It's like every explanation. It's like, well, this is the closest thing. It's owls, right? It's not goblins. Can't be goblins. It's owls.
Right. And the chain of information, if it has a weak link, then it does. If they would tell you scientifically, if you're trying to present something scientific, that you can't have any weak links in that presentation.
Right.
Yet when you're being skeptical about it or you're trying to debunk it, you can make assumptions along the way. And no, this is ball lightning. Yeah, but it was underwater. And it's like, it doesn't matter. This is ball lightning. You get to do that.
Yeah.
But if we're scientifically trying to prove it is if the other way, then every single part of it has to stand up to scrutiny.
Yeah, this is, his name is Joe Mergia online. Mm, He's a UFO filmmaker and documentarian.
Yes,
he had a great counterpoint to that old chestnut, which was commonly attributed to Carl Sagan. But I believe, of course, like every other great saying or idea, it came before him in other forms, and that extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. I think he did say that, but I don't think he came up with that. Of course, it's not that novel of an idea. But so that's presented as like, no, if you're making this extraordinary claim that there's some semi-sentient disc floating under the water, then you need to have extraordinary proof. And Joe's point was that, no, you don't really. You just need the same amount of proof and the same standards as every other scientific claim. And I loved it because you're right. That's it. Why are the rules different for some other scientific happening or observation?
Everything is extraordinary before you understand.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's like, you can have a mathematical proof for electricity or this and that. And to somebody in the 17th century, it would seem extraordinary. And that's the extraordinary proof. Yeah. And if you proved it to them, only a few, maybe Isaac Newton in that century, would understand it perhaps. But it would be possibly fantastical to him. And I'm sure he would marvel at the leaps and bounds of science to get people's heads around that. And so the concept is that you got to expand your thinking, or just, like I said, don't cut it off just yet because you don't know. But like I said, that's all they got. So that's what they're going with it. And I understand that.
that's the only tools we have in the toolbox. So we're just going to use the hammer and the chisel. We're not going to use the laser-guided iPhone app stud finder because that's not in our toolbox yet. We got the hammer. We nail things with it. That's it. So I understand that. But my point is, with this story and like all these others, is that, look, I have fun with this. I just entertain the thoughts because I like philosophy. I like using my brain to like wonder, what if that were true? And then what is it? And what does it mean to us? And what makes me a little disappointed is when you have most of these other mainstream institutions saying like, no, we don't really, no, that's too out there. So we're not going to do it. But I understand that. But always keep watching whatever it is.
Well, what stays with me here in Eric's story, it isn't the light. It's how hard he tried to get rid of it or convince himself that he was seeing things. He's blinking, he's cleaning his sunglasses, he's looking away to reset his eyes and looking back. All stuff that is actually seems to indicate some sort of training. I need to make sure this is real and assess what I'm actually seeing. And this thing just keeps sliding boat to boat in full daylight. And he watches it settle near that little dock. He hikes all the way down there to check and finds nothing. And then he just files it under weird and gets on with his day. Now, he's not asking it to mean anything, and that's the part we keep circling back to. We got this careful guy, clear morning, something that doesn't behave the way something should behave in the water or the way water behaves even. And there's a lot of researchers and ufology pundits out there these days that will tell you not only are we not alone, they've been here all along, and they live beneath the sea, no matter what these sketchy research papers say. Maybe that's what Eric saw. We can tell you, we believe you, man. Thanks so much for sending your story into the Astonishing Dead Letter Office.
The Astonishing Dead Letter Office is hosted by Scott Philbrick and Faris Burgess and is executive produced by Tess Feifel. The show is edited and mixed by Sarah Voorhees-Wendell at VW Sound. The theme is based on the Astonishing Legends theme by Judson Crane at Founder Music, arranged by Alan Caricia, who composes all the other music in the show. Tommy Beaver Design created the logo. The announcer is John Bowler. That's me. Stories are lightly edited for length, content, and readability, but otherwise presented as they're sent to us. We're always looking for more dead letters, so if you have a story of your own you'd like to share, email it to deadletteroffice@astonishinglegends.com. Please include how you would like to be credited. First name only, first name last initial, anonymous, a pseudonym. Let us know. Due to the number of emails coming in, we often cannot respond, but we do read them all. No part of this show may be reproduced anywhere without permission. Copyright Astonishing Legends Productions.